Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Well, good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call coming to you from Penang on this Monday, the 2nd of November 2015. Well, companies with investment-grade credit ratings are the cream of the crop, high-grade corporate borrowers, and they've been gorging on borrowed money at super low interest rates over the past few years. Interest on that mountain of debt grew another 4% in the second quarter, and now it's eating their earnings like never before. According to JP Morgan analysts cited by Bloomberg, these companies have incurred $119 billion in interest expense over the 12 months through the second quarter. The most ever. With impeccable timing, for S&P 500 companies' revenues have been in a recession all year, and the last thing companies need now is higher expenses. Risks are piling up, too. According to Bloomberg, companies' ability to pay these interest expenses, as measured by the interest coverage ratio, dropped to the lowest level since 2009. Companies also have to refinance that debt when it comes due. If they can't, they'll end up going through what the beaten-down energy and mining sectors are undergoing right now, reshuffling assets and debts, some of it in bankruptcy court. The benefits of refinancing at lower rates are dwindling more and more. Companies saved a mere 0.21 percentage point in the second quarter on refinancings, as investors demanded average yields of 3.12% to own high-grade corporate debt, which is about half a percentage point more than the post-crisis low in May 2013. That was in the second quarter. Since then, conditions have worsened. Moody's AAA Corporate Bond Yield Index, which tracks the highest-rated borrowers, was at 3.29% in early February. In July last year, it was even lower for a few moments. So refinancing old debt at these super-low interest rates was a deal. But last week, the index was over 4%. It currently sits at 3.93%. And the benefits of refinancing at even lower yields are disappearing fast. What's left is a record amount of debt, generating a record amount of interest expense, even at these still very low yields. Increasingly alarming is what Goldman's credit strategists, led by Lotfi Karoui, called this deterioration of corporate balance sheets. And it will get worse as yields edge up and as corporate revenues and earnings sink deeper into the mire of the slowing global economy. But these are the cream of the credit crop. At the other end of the spectrum, which the JP Morgan analysts, probably holding their noses, did not address, are the junk-rated masses of over-indebted corporate America. For deep junk CCC-rated borrowers, replacing old debt with new debt has suddenly got to be much more expensive or even impossible, as yields have shot up from the low last June of around 8% to around 14% these days. Investors are coming out of their trance and are opening their eyes and are finally demanding higher returns to take on these risks. Even high-grade borrowers are feeling the long-dormant urge by investors to be once again compensated for risk, at least a tiny bit. If the global economy slows down further, and if revenues and earnings get dragged down with it, all of which are now part of the scenario, these highly leveraged balance sheets will further pressure already iffy earnings, and investors will get even colder feet. In a hail of credit downgrades and demand even more compensation for taking on these risks. It starts a vicious circle, even in high-grade debt. Alas, much of the debt wasn't invested in productive assets that would generate income and make it easier to service the debt. Instead, companies ploughed this money into dizzying amounts of share repurchases designed to prop up the company's stock and nothing else. And they ploughed it into grandiose mergers and acquisitions and into other worthy financial engineering projects. Now the money's gone. The debt remains. And the interest has to be paid. It's the hangover after a long party. And even Wall Street is starting to fret, according to Bloomberg, and I quote, "The borrowing has gotten so aggressive that for the first time in about 5 years, equity fund managers who said they'd prefer companies use cash flow to improve their balance sheets outnumbered those who said they'd rather have it returned to their stockholders," according to a survey by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. End of quote. But it's still not sinking in. Companies are still announcing share buybacks with breathtaking amounts, even as revenues and earnings are stuck in a quagmire. They want to prop up their shares in one last desperate effort. In the past, this sort of financial engineering worked. Every year since 2007, companies that bought back their own shares aggressively saw their shares outperform the S&P 500 index. But it isn't working anymore. Bloomberg found that since May, shares of companies that have ploughed the most into share buybacks have fallen even further than the S&P 500. Walmart is a prime example. Turns out, once financial engineering fails, all bets are off. You only have to look at the deterioration of overall corporate credit ratings. High-grade borrowers, rated A2 or higher, have access to funds even in difficult times, but their number has been shrinking as companies have mucked up their balance sheets by borrowing more for M&A and share repurchases. There is a real cost to financial engineering. Downgrades have pushed these companies into lower credit categories. Through 2011, high-grade companies were the top bond issuers. But now medium-grade companies, that's those rated A3 or BAA, have become the most prolific bond issuers. From 1995 through the second quarter of 2012, issuance by high-grade companies was on average nearly double the issuance by medium-grade companies. But since then, medium-grade offerings outpaced high-grade offerings on average by 24% per year. By the third quarter, medium-grade issuance soared 47% year over year, despite higher yields and wider spreads, and even as junk bond issuance collapsed. There is now a total of $3.36 trillion in medium-grade bonds outstanding. During the 10-year period ended in 2005, medium-grade bonds averaged 31% of total bonds outstanding. Now their share has soared to 52%. The share of high-grade bonds at $1.79 trillion has plunged to 28% in the third quarter. And the share of junk bonds outstanding, the most vulnerable of the bunch, has soared to over 20%. Many of these companies were downgraded since they issued these bonds a few years ago. And when these bonds mature, they have to be refinanced with lower rated and thus more expensive debt if they can refinance them at all. This deterioration in credit indicates that companies are losing what they call financial flexibility, as Moody's puts it. Lower rated borrowers are experiencing higher credit costs. For them, access to credit becomes difficult or even impossible. That's when they run out of money and end up in default, Moody's concludes, quote unquote. To compensate, corporate outlays on staff and capital goods may be curbed more rapidly in response to a weaker business outlook. This sort of cost-cutting via layoffs and slashing of capital expenditures has been wreaking havoc in the energy sector for a year. But it's spreading as the recent rounds of layoff announcements and cost reduction programs have shown. This sort of reaction to tightening credit is how it started out at the end of the last three credit booms, the ones that ended in recessions and in financial crisis. Risks have been building up in the banking sector. Quoting the Comptroller of the Currency, reminds me of what happened in mortgage-backed securities in the run-up to the crisis. Well, here are a few words on last week's congressional testimony from that foul Clinton woman concerning her serial lies about Libya by Andrew P. Napolitano. Many of you will remember him. He is a former judge of the Supreme Court of New Jersey and a frequent critical broadcaster. The New York Times' Maureen Dowd captured the moment last weekend when she referred to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the midwife to chaos in Libya. Dowd apparently came to that conclusion after watching Clinton bobbing and weaving and admitting and denying as she was confronted with the partial record of her failures and obfuscations as Secretary of State, particularly with respect to Libya. The public record is well known. In March 2011, President Barack Obama declared war on Libya. He did this at the urging of Clinton, who wanted to overthrow Libyan strongman Colonel Muammar Gaddafi so she could boast of having brought democracy to the region. She and Obama conspired to do this, even though former President George W. Bush and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair had publicly praised Gaddafi as an ally in the war against terrorist groups, and even though the US was giving the Gaddafi government more than $100 million a year in foreign aid. Obama did his best to avoid constitutional norms. He deployed American intelligence agents on the ground, not troops, so he could plausibly deny he had put boots on the ground. He did not seek an American national consensus for war because Libya presented no threat whatever to the United States. He did not obtain a congressional declaration of war, as the Constitution requires, because he couldn't get one. And he did not seek United Nations permission, which is required to attack a fellow UN member. He did obtain a UN embargo of the shipment of weapons into Libya, and he secured a NATO-enforced no-fly zone over portions of Libya. In order to enforce the no-fly zone, NATO sent jet fighters over the skies of Libya. The jets were guided and directed by American intelligence agents on the ground to bomb Libyan planes on the ground, which had been paid for by American taxpayers. To pursue her goal of a democratic government there. Clinton, along with Obama and a dozen or so members of Congress from both houses and both political parties, decided she should break the law by permitting US arms dealers to violate the UN arms embargo and arm Libyan rebels whom she hoped would one day run the new government. So she exercised her authority as Secretary of State to authorize the shipment of American-made arms to Qatar, a country beholden to the Muslim Brotherhood and friendly to the Libyan rebels, and a country the US had no business arming, unless the purpose of doing so was for the arms to be transferred to the rebels. Once this plot was hatched, Clinton and her fellow conspirators realized that some of these rebel groups were manned by Al-Qaeda operatives, and selling or providing arms to them is a felony. Hence the reason for months' worth of missing and destroyed Clinton emails. How could someone running for president possibly justify providing military assistance to terrorist organizations in the present international climate? Flash forward to Clinton's public testimony before the House Benghazi Committee last week. Clinton had three audiences to address. Her immediate audience was the committee, whose members generally did not know how to ask questions of a witness trying to hide the truth. Her second audience was the American people, who will recall little more than 15-second sound bites and general impressions of her testimony. Her third, unseen audience consisted of the FBI agents and federal prosecutors who are investigating her. That audience was looking for perjury, misleading statements, and what federal law calls bad acts. Perjury is lying under oath. Misleading Congress is criminal and consists of testimony that employs deceptive language so as to create an untruthful impression. Bad acts constitute repeated behavior demonstrating moral turpitude, usually a pattern of deception. The FBI agents surely heard Clinton mislead Congress when she answered a hard question about arms going to rebels by saying, "I think the answer is no," and again when she answered a question about arming private militias by saying it may have been considered but wasn't seriously considered. And they heard her directly commit perjury when she was asked whether she knew about the countries supplying arms to Libyan rebels directly or indirectly, and she answered no. How could she answer no? She not only knew about the sending of arms to rebels, but also personally authored and authorized it. How could she answer no? The FBI and CIA advised her in documents that are now public that US arms were making their way to known Al-Qaeda operatives. How could she answer no? This reached a crisis point when some of those operatives used their American-made weapons to murder U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens at the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Then the cover-up began. At the same time, Clinton was telling her daughter and the Egyptian Prime Minister within hours of Stevens' death that Al-Qaeda killed him. And after the CIA told her the plot to kill Stevens had been hatched 12 days earlier, she told the public that Stevens was killed by spontaneous demonstrators angered about a cheap anti-Islam video, the producer of which she vowed to get. She later angrily dismissed questions over this cover-up by arguing, "What difference at this point does it make?" The difference it makes goes to the heart of the American electoral process. Every 4 years, America entrusts awesome power to a person who swears to protect the Constitution. How could America give that power to a consistent public liar who, for personal political gain, midwifed terror and chaos in a country that was America's ally and whose words and behaviour have continually demonstrated that she is utterly unworthy of belief? Well, in what appears to be a move of desperation, President Obama reversed his previous declarations, repeated dozens of times, that there would be, quote-unquote, no American boots on the ground in Syria. The Obama administration on Friday announced that 50 special operations forces would be deployed to northern Syria to provide so-called training and assistance. Analysts are saying that Obama was goaded into the U-turn because Russia and Iran have stolen the limelight in Syria, making the US irrelevant. Some criticized Obama's escalation of the American military involvement, while others called it too little, too late. Some analysts said the move was pointless because 50 troops can't accomplish anything. CNN's military analyst Robert Baer said, "Put in hundreds of thousands of troops or don't get in at all." There were unconfirmed reports that the administration is planning further escalations. This comes just a month after President Obama's latest escalation in the American involvement in the Afghanistan war. He had repeatedly declared that Americans would withdraw long before he left office. But the withdrawal date was extended several times and will now extend into the term of the next president. Once again, further escalations are almost certain to be necessary. Well, Caterpillar tells us that not only have sales been falling every month for the last 3 years, but also that its losses are becoming more widespread. In September, not one of its reporting regions saw an increase. Either Caterpillar is a terribly mismanaged company, which is unlikely, or something else is going on. Taking the train from Baltimore to New York, you go through the great metropolis of Trenton, New Jersey. There, on the lower Trenton Bridge, in full view of the passengers, is a faded sign, evidence of the burg's faded glory. Trenton makes, the world takes. That sign was put up in 1935, when it was true. By the 1980s, Trenton was doing the taking. One of the places from which it took the most was China. The US was the China of the early 20th century. It was the world's low-cost producer, its leading exporter of manufactured goods. In World War I, it was to the US that Britain, then the world's leading empire, turned. Britain needed food, fuel, guns, trucks, and everything else necessary to fight a war. The US happily took the orders until Britain went bust. But that was not the end of the story. After the war, gold continued to come into the US in payment for war debts. Gold was still the foundation of the US money supply. This increase in America's gold reserves provided the stage for a huge inflationary boom. The Roaring Twenties was an economic and financial bubble. It was the result of two things: having more money to lend and spend, and central bank manipulation. In 1927, in the face of a mild slowdown at home induced by Henry Ford shutting down assembly lines to retool for the Model A, the Fed decided to lower interest rates. As far as we know, this was the first time the Fed intervened in the credit market, seeking to improve the economy. It was a disaster. Following the Fed's move, the US stock market shot up by about 40%. Moms and pops jumped into the stock market, hoping to get rich. Margin debt surged, factories added capacity, spending soared. Then the stock market collapsed. The situation probably would have been resolved fairly quickly had not the spirit of activism also infected the rest of the government. President Hoover was on the case, followed by President Roosevelt. Both clumsily tried to do something to stop the correction. Their actions stretched a normal correction into the Great Depression. But that's a long story. What's important today is understanding how monetary stimulus sent an economy into hyperdrive, leading to a crash and a depression. It happened to the world's leading export nation, the US, in the 1920s and 30s. Arguably, something similar is happening to the world's leading exporter now. Now it's China that makes. Trenton and the rest of the US take. But as leading Asia expert Jim Walker of Asianomics recently told Chris Lowe for the Bonner and Partners Investor Network, China will be lucky to grow GDP by between 3 and 5% over the next 2 or 3 years. Many people say China works according to different rules, that it follows a different set of economic principles. Yeah, yeah, this place is different. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have news for you. Gravity works in China just as it does elsewhere. After its roaring 1990s and 2000s, China must be coming back to earth. Many other things are falling too. When Chinese factories make less noise, they need less iron ore, copper, and oil. And when they need less of these resources, the countries that provide them have less money to spend. That's why emerging markets have been sliding for the last year. But they're not the only ones. China expanded to meet the demand from its overseas customers, many of them in the US. Now, those customers have less to spend. Less money goes to China. Its foreign exchange reserves fall. Its money supply drops. Its economy slows. And the world economy slows with it. Most likely, that is the meaning of Caterpillar's latest earnings reports, with global sales down 11 months in a row at double-digit rates. Well, Tony Blair has finally said sorry for the Iraq war and admitted he could be partly to blame for the rise of the Islamic State. The extraordinary confession by the former Prime Minister comes after 12 years in which he refused to apologise for the conflict. Blair makes his dramatic mea culpa during a TV interview about the hell caused by his and George Bush's decision to oust Saddam Hussein. In the exchange, Blair repeatedly says sorry for his conduct and even refers to claims that the invasion was a war crime, while denying he committed one. Blair is asked bluntly in the CNN interview, "Was the Iraq war a mistake?" He replies, and I quote, "I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we received was wrong. I also apologize for some of the mistakes in planning and certainly our mistake in our understanding of what would happen once you removed the regime." challenged that the Iraq war was the principal cause of the rise of Islamic State, he said, "I think there are elements of truth in that." End of quote. In the trial by TV, respected US political broadcaster Fareed Zakaria accuses him of being President Bush's poodle over the conflict. In his CNN interview, Blair candidly asks for forgiveness for his blunder in not realizing, quote-unquote, what would happen once you removed the regime. Sir John Chilcot is leading the long-delayed inquiry into the Iraq war and the key figures, including Blair and other senior Labour politicians, are understood to have been given notice of the broad thrust of Chilcot's verdict on them, expected to be made public next year. Blair may have calculated that since Chilcot is likely to accuse him of major errors of judgment, it is better for him to volunteer an apology now rather than be forced to do so if, as seems certain, Chilcot's damning assessment gives him little choice. The former Prime Minister's decision to make his apology in the US as opposed to the UK is also significant. Far from presenting his apology in a harsh, critical light, CNN interviewer Zakaria, a personal friend of Blair, showers praise on him for being the only interviewee in the programme who, quote-unquote, took responsibility for Iraq on camera. Blair is, of course, a known master of public relations and media manipulation.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, they say, comparison is the thief of joy. And this, as it turns out, is one cliché that has a raft of empirical evidence backing it up. But there is another truth about social comparison. It's pretty much inevitable, so you may as well learn to use it to your advantage. Say, Adam Galinsky and Morris Schweitzer, both social psychologists and authors of the new book, Friend and Foe, When to Cooperate, When to Compete, and How to Succeed at Both. In their book, Galinsky and Schweitzer argue that social comparison is an innate human tendency, and, whether it's the wisest move or not, it's a big part of the way we determine our own level of happiness. Even monkeys judge what they've got by taking a peek at what the monkey next door is getting, according to a classic study by Emory University scientist Frans de Waal. De Waal trained capuchin monkeys to essentially use stones as a kind of currency, exchanging one for a nice cucumber slice. The monkeys were perfectly happy with this arrangement until De Waal started giving some, but not all, of the monkeys a sweet, juicy grape instead of the cucumber. Like humans, monkeys would much rather have something sweet than a boring vegetable. Quote unquote. Upon seeing this inequity, the monkey who was offered the regular cucumber went, well, apeshit. Galinsky and Schweitzer write. The monkeys who perceived themselves as receiving a lesser deal became visibly upset, refusing to pay for the cucumber, or sometimes throwing the slice back in the experimenter's face. What this experiment demonstrates, the authors write, is that our evolutionary ancestors did not evaluate their outcomes in isolation, rather they evaluated outcomes in a comparative process. End of quote. For a human example of this phenomenon, Galinsky and Schweitzer tell the story of a man named Scott Crabtree, who had dutifully climbed the corporate ladder at his company, steadily earning incremental raises. He was fine with this, until, that is, a just-out-of-college kid was hired and immediately began earning almost exactly the same salary as him, a figure that had taken Crabtree decades to earn. The infuriating comparison made him so unhappy that he soon left the company where he'd happily worked for many years. Quoting Schweitzer, "We are hardwired to engage in comparisons. That is, we can't get away from it, and we're doing it to try to make sense of our world. Do I make enough money? Do I need to update my kitchen? Do I need a new car? Are my kids doing well? It's almost impossible to make those assessments objectively. So instead, we turn to comparisons." End of quote. And that was Schweitzer in an interview with Science of Us. So if comparison is unavoidable, then, the authors argue, you'd best learn how to work with it. Because rivalries, of course, can be motivating. Schweitzer and Galinsky point to a study by New York University psychologist Gavin Kilduff, who found that people tend to perform better when their rivals are present, as compared to their performance against random strangers. More specifically, he analyzed the race results of local running clubs and found that people tended to run faster if their rival was also racing that day. Multiple rivals meant the runner sped through the course even faster. Comparison can be motivating, but it can also make you miserable. The best part of Schweitzer and Kalinsky's book, by the way, is the author's refusal to argue for one of these truths over the other. Instead, they recognize that competitive and cooperative feelings can and do coexist within the same person, and neither feeling is necessarily superior. It's learning when to use that feeling that counts. Take a classic study in psychology on Olympic medalists recounted in the book. Silver medalists tend to be miserable because they're comparing themselves to the gold medalists. Bronze medalists, on the other hand, are comparing their outcome to those who came in fourth and beyond, so they tend to be more pleased with themselves than the silver medalists, even though the silver winners technically beat them. To that end, Galinsky and Schweitzer write that, quote-unquote, "When it comes to social comparison to book your own motivation, here is the key rule to keep in mind. Seek favorable comparisons if you want to feel happier, and seek unfavorable comparisons if you want to push yourself harder." Well, you may not be able to quit your social comparison habit, but you can learn to make it work for you. All right, well, the other day here on the show, I pointed out how China's dropping exports and plunging imports had collided with long-term bets by the shipping industry that has been counting on majestic, endless growth. This is what Thomson Reuters had called the inevitable fallout from China's unsustainable and poorly executed credit splurge. The industry has been adding capacity in quantum leaps where, quote-unquote, the scramble to order so-called ultra-large container vessels had turned into a stampede. And that's the Journal of Commerce speaking. Unlike a lot of official data emerging from China, the index is operated by the Shanghai Shipping Exchange and sponsored by the Chinese Ministry of Communications, and thus it is raw, unvarnished, not seasonally adjusted or otherwise beautified. It's volatile, and it is a true reflection of reality, as measured by how much it costs to ship containers from China to 14 major destinations around the world. And these rates are based on contractual and spot market rates. In other words, as with most shipping indices, they are very hard to fudge and misrepresent, if not impossible. So they are extremely reliable. These rates are a function of oversupply of shipping capacity and of lackluster demand for shipping containers to distant corners of the world. They've been in trouble since February. Trouble is a euphemism. They relentlessly plunged. By early July, the index dropped below 800 for the first time in its history, which started in 1998 when the index was set at 1,000. It soon recovered to about 850. And just when bouts of hope were rising that the worst was over, it plunged again and hit even lower levels. The latest weekly reading dropped another 1.7% from the prior week to 752.21, the worst level ever. The CCFI is now 30% below where it had been in February this year and 25% below where it had been 17 years ago at its inception. The Shanghai Containerized Freight Index is also operated by the Shanghai Shipping Exchange. It tracks spot rates of shipping containers from Shanghai to 15 major destinations around the world. It's even more volatile than the CCFI. But being based on spot rates as opposed to contractual rates, it's a good indicator where the CCFI is headed. For last week, the CCFI plunged 5.4% to a new record low of 531.73, down 46% from where it had been at its inception in 2009 when it was set at 1,000, and down 52% from February. Very, very grim, ladies and gentlemen. You are not hearing this from the mainstream press, in case you hadn't noticed. Well, the personal storage industry rakes in $22 billion each year, and it's only getting bigger. The reason is not because vast nations of hoarders have finally decided to get their act together and clean out the whole closet. It's also not because we're short on space. In 1950, the average size of a home in the US was 983 square feet. Compare that to 2011, when American houses ballooned to an average size of 2,480 square feet, almost triple the size. And finally, it's not because of growing families. This will no doubt come as a great relief to helpful sociologists who each week kindly suggest that for maximum environmental impact, we simply stop procreating altogether. Family sizes in the Western world are steadily shrinking, from an average of 3.37 people in 1950 to just 2.6 today. So if US houses have tripled in size while the number of people living in them has shrunk, what exactly is America doing with all of this extra space? And why the billions of dollars tossed to an industry that was virtually non-existent a generation or two ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's because of your stuff. What kind of stuff? Who cares? Whatever fits. Furniture, clothing, children's toys, for those not fans of deprivation, that is, games, kitchen gadgets, and darling tchotchkes that don't do anything but take up space and look pretty for a season or two before being replaced by other newer things, equally pretty but equally useless. The simple truth is this. You can read all the books and buy all the cute cubbies and baskets and chalkboard labels, even master the life-changing magic of cleaning up. But if you have more stuff than you do space to store it easily, your life will be spent a slave to your possessions. America shops because it's bored, anxious, depressed, or angry. And Americans make the mistake of buying material goods thinking they are treats which will fill the hole, soothe the wound, make them feel better. The problem is they're not treats, they're responsibilities. And what we own very quickly begins to own us. The second you open your wallet to buy something, it costs you, and in more ways than you may think. Yes, of course, there's the price tag and the corresponding amount of time it took to earn that amount of money. But possessions also cost you space in your home and time spent cleaning and maintaining them. And as the token environmentalist in the room, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you that when you buy something, you're also taking on the task of disposing of it, responsibly or not, when you're done with it. America's addiction to consumption is a vicious one, and it's stressing America out. I know this because I myself have experienced it, having lived in everything from a one-room bedsit come kitchen with a shower unit to a four-bedroom house. But I'm also bringing some cold, hard science to the table. A study published by UCLA showed that women's stress hormones peaked during the times that they were dealing with their possessions and material goods. Anyone who parks on the street because they can't fit their car into the garage, or who has stared down a crammed closet, can relate. Addiction to consuming is having a markedly negative impact on virtually every aspect of American lives. America's current solution to having too much stuff is as short-sighted as it is ineffective. When America runs out of space, it simply buys a bigger house. This solution will never work, and the reason it will never work is that possessions seem to hold strange scientific properties. They expand to fill the space you provide for them. This is why some normal adult human beings can live in houses just 426 square feet, and others find that not even their 2,500 square foot McMansion feels big enough. It's almost never the amount of space that's the problem, but the amount of stuff. So if bigger homes aren't the solution, let's look and see what is. I suggest heading in the exact opposite direction. Deliberately choose a life with less. Buy less, and instantly you have less to store. You use less space. Eventually, you can work less to pay for all this stuff. Soon, you will stress less too, and above all, your life will involve less waste. If you're wondering where to begin, don't. You know exactly where this journey begins. It begins with the stuff that makes you feel guilty, stressed, or overwhelmed when you look at it. The clothing with price tags still on them, the toys that no one plays with, the boxes and boxes of stuff you're storing in the attic, basement, and garage, just in case. Get rid of it. Recycle it. Donate it. Sell it on Craigslist. And when you're done getting rid of it, stop buying more. Because when it comes to stuff, I promise you, you don't need more labels or better systems or complicated Pinterest tutorials. All you need is less. Well, the National Mortgage Risk Index, which measures inversely the stability and health of the real estate markets, has increased every month since January 2014, meaning that the real estate markets are becoming less stable and less healthy, as they did in the mid-2000s decade, prior to the collapse of the housing bubble. Some of the findings in the report by the American Enterprise Institute are: credit requirements for first-time buyers are being weakened, just as in the creation of the mid-2000s housing bubble. The same abusive practices that were common with subprime mortgages are recurring. For example, in September, 70% had down payments less than or equal to 5%. Fueled by historically low mortgage rates and growing leverage from low down payments, real home prices have been increasing rapidly for 36 straight months, 12.5% higher today than in 2012, far outstripping income growth and crimping affordability. The Federal Housing Authority, or FHA, cut its annual insurance premiums early this year as a kind of social program to make houses more affordable. However, instead of increasing affordability, the insurance premium cut has largely resulted in the purchase of higher-priced homes. According to the report, and I quote, "The typical first-time buyer today puts little money down and chooses a mortgage that pays off very slowly. This combination means that many first-time buyers are only one recession away from being significantly underwater." End of quote. I have my own painful memories of the last housing bubble in the mid-2000s decade. I implored people here on the show not to buy houses and to sell those they did have, which were highly leveraged. But they didn't listen. After the bubble burst, it was heartbreaking to see them financially destroyed. It's going to happen again, and it won't be pleasant. Well, recession is coming and depression will follow. The US economy is 70% consumer dependent, which means it can only survive if people spend beyond their means and credit is still available. There is a $13 trillion consumer debt, with $3 trillion in auto, student, and credit card debt. For the next 15 years, there will be 10,000 seniors added each day. The senior population will be about 87 million by 2029, and this is the age bracket for the biggest deleveraging in the economy. Two recent surveys reveal most Americans to be living on the brink of financial collapse. The average U.S. wage is $45,000, with 61% of Americans with less than $1,000 in savings and 21% without a savings account. The highest median net worth age group is 65 to 69, with $195,000 in net worth, but $150,000 of that is in home equity. For the past 8 years, the crooks at the Federal Reserve and Wall Street banks were able to wipe out the golden years for seniors with crazy ZIRP, or zero interest rate, policy. In addition, this act forced so many seniors to collect early Social Security and forfeit thousands over time. The banks will give you nothing for your deposit, but charge you outlandish fees and loan shark credit card rates. What a great scam when the borrower sets the rate instead of the lender. Finally, the double-digit increase in health insurance and the triple-digit penalty of Obamacare mandate, along with rising property tax, sales tax, water and utility tax, and garbage tax. Where on God's earth will the American people find all the money to keep this crazy economy afloat? The latest Bloomberg report stated the top 100 CEOs' retirement account is equal to 41% of U.S. families' savings. While the CEOs are collecting ransom-sized paychecks and amassing a fortune in their golden parachute, the average middle class is being sent to the poorhouse. Well, Walmart has over 5,000 stores in the United States. We tend to think of Walmart as the low-price leader, crushing prices to their rock-bottom level by cutting costs at every corner. However, dollar stores are an even lower-cost option, and many working-class Americans are turning to these stores. Dollar stores have seen a dramatic rise in numbers thanks to the ongoing effects of the recession. There are more than 11,500 Dollar General stores in the United States, twice the amount of Walmart locations. The growth in dollar stores is reflecting the cash crunch many Americans are facing. I've mentioned this in the past, but many dollar stores have suddenly become low-cost grocery stores as people struggle to get by. This is a smart strategy to tap into the ever-growing number of Americans on food stamps. It's expected that by 2016, over 30,000 dollar stores will exist in the United States. It's interesting to see the transformation of dollar stores. I remember when these places largely sold overbought products or items that simply didn't sell at larger retailers. That's no longer the case. These places now sell food, and many big-name brands have adjusted packaging so the growing percentage of Americans represented by lower-income households can purchase food. This trend shows no signs of slowing. By next year, there will be over 30,000 dollar stores in the United States. This is a 25% growth rate since 2011. Even Walmart can't meet this growth rate since it has grown at about 20% since 2011 in the number of stores opening. There's a bigger market in cheaper retailers compared to already low-cost Walmart, which reflects a growing number of Americans working in low-wage jobs. To put this in perspective, consider that Dollar General, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree are all in the top seven of stores in the United States. In many cases, there are more dollar stores than certain gas stations. They're doing well because they're tapping into two things: Americans' love of spending and the growing number of people with little income who love to spend what little they do have. You only have to look at the number of Americans on food stamps. It's staggering. Roughly 46 million Americans receive food stamps. This is a large number of the population, but it also highlights the growth in dollar stores and their shift in serving food items versus other low-cost trinkets. They're tapping into a market that tends to grow when the economy does poorly. And with low-wage job growth soaring, they're continuing to do well. A large part of their customers is coming to them in the form of millennials who are struggling to make it in this new, tough economy. Dollar General's stock is up 140% in the last 5 years. Welcome to the dollar store recovery. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the real story that came out of the Fed's policy-making meeting last week is this. The Fed remains delusional. In its statement, the Fed said that the economy was expanding, quote-unquote, at a moderate pace. A quote-unquote, household spending and business fixed investment has been increasing at solid rates in recent months. Solid? That statement stands in contradiction to retail sales reports, consumer spending, durable goods orders, consumer confidence surveys, and a raft of other economic data. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I do hope that you remembered to put your clocks back, and that gives me a 13-hour difference between myself and the east coast of the United States. Means I have to stay up an hour later for the winter months. Roll on, March, I say. Well, in any case, have a wonderful week ahead. I look forward to talking to you again on Friday. And until then, this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.